Okay, so Psalm 19, Jesus is Lord, creation's voice proclaims it, Psalm 19. Harvest times are occasions when we take time to acknowledge the amazing kindness of the living God in consistently providing for us in so many ways. This evening we'll look at the harvest festivals of Leviticus 23. If you're like me, Leviticus is probably your favourite book of the Bible, so you'll just be like, oh, not that again, not all that stuff, but no, it's worth another go. But this morning we'll look at Psalm 19. Harvest. Well, in modern times, when we get our food delivered to the door, ordered from the internet, we're easily disconnected from the basic processes of food production. Even though we know it, it's still hard to just really connect that up when it's so abstracted for many of us. But here today, we deliberately take a weekend to stop and give thanks to the living God for his amazing faithfulness in creating and sustaining the heavens and the earth. And we're going to just, the point of this really is to stop and say, hang on a minute, this stuff comes from his hand. Everything we have comes from him. We take time to stop and appreciate the glory of the majestic God displayed for us in everything around us. Difficulty is that we live in a culture that sees the physical world as, well, that's just natural. That's devoid of deeper meaning. Physical world around us, that's facts. And that's just there, it's just what it is, it's got no significance, it's got no deeper meaning. And all the God stuff, the Jesus stuff, well, that's dumped into a great big kind of bargain bin with ghosts, crop circles, Derren Brown, alien visitations, magic crystals. Do you see Derren Brown? Did anyone get stuck in the seat? Nah, no one. No, I was real disappointed. Anyway, now, that's the thing, isn't it? It's all like, oh, God stuff. You know, you like Derren Brown, don't you? You know, religious person like you, Derren Brown, crystals, crop circles. I'm like, no, whoa, it's got nothing to do with that. What's that stuff? But that's the category, isn't it? It's natural world, facts, science, rational, no deeper meaning. It's just what it is. And then if you want to be into that stuff, okay, you know, whatever. If we take... But the problem with that is that if we take natural things for granted and then see supernatural things as weird and, well, kind of irrelevant, really, well, then we're going to struggle to take harvest seriously. Obviously, it's harvest. It's like, oh, yeah, God, yeah. Well, you know, crops grow anyway, don't they? That's just, you know, that's just science. That's agriculture. What's God really got to do with that? That's how we'll think. In fact, we're going to struggle to take anything to do with God seriously at all if we really think that nature, natural, supernatural, because if God's only in the supernatural bracket and only rubbish stuff's in there in the culture, well, God's not really very serious, is he, if that's how we're thinking? See, if the normal, natural processes of life are seen as having nothing to do with the living God, then it's unlikely we will ever really think about him or do anything about him or with him until it's too late. So in a deep sense, taking time this morning to think again about the natural world, maybe one of the most revolutionary things we ever do. If we could view the seasons and the cycle of day and night in the profound way that the Bible does, then we may find that we think and live in ways we could never have dreamed. Psalm 19 is one of many parts of these ancient scriptures that tell us that The natural world around us speaks about the living God and all his plans for the world. At this weekend of Harvest Thanksgiving, we want to take this moment to consider again what the natural world has to say about the living God. As we look at fresh fruit and veg, looking down at some very tasty leeks there. Quite like leeks. I've kind of got into leeks more recently. I'm quite a big slow cooker person. There's some in cooking right now, actually. I like them. So I'm just sort of looking down at various things here and thinking, yeah, there's fruit, veg, all sorts of provisions here, flowers. Or we kind of discovered the Trough of Bowland. Amazing, isn't it? And nobody goes there, or there hardly was anyone we were there, and it's like amazing. We had a picnic out there, real nice. And when we look at all these things, sometimes we at least get a sense that some great meaning or message is being spoken to us. Lots of people experience that. Many people stand on the seashore, mountaintop, whatever, and perhaps for the first time hear the first words of the mighty speech that the natural world is constantly shouting. I mean, Psalm 19 is telling, isn't it? There's loads of words constantly being spoken. Every tongue, language, nobody fails to listen. Nobody fails to be an audience for this speech that is constantly being spoken in every part of the world, in every language. Everyone hears a sermon of creation. And sometimes people say, oh, I was standing there and I just thought the summing to this. What are they hearing? They're obviously not hearing very much, but they're hearing something. What is it? So if you take a moment to acknowledge that the living God speaks to us through his glorious creation in all his wonderful provision for us, let's listen again to Psalm 19. Look at those opening verses of Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. King David wrote this around 3,000 years ago. We can imagine this incredible poet warrior, philosopher king, lying down in the Judean desert, no pollution, no city light pollution. If you ever experienced something like that, where you're right away from the light pollution of a city, or pollution that atmospheric pollution, and you're just getting a really clear, completely dark view of the night sky. It's unbelievable, isn't it? If you've experienced that, it's just on another level completely to what you normally see. I can imagine David doing that, lying in the Judean desert, gazing up at the night sky and listening to the eternal sermon that the stars were preaching. We know he wasn't the only ancient philosopher listening to this sermon being preached by the heavens, because the greatest stargazers from all over the world gathered in Bethlehem 1,000 years later to look at the great world leader that the stars had described and announced. But can we really see the reality of Jesus proclaimed in the whole creation around us? We kind of sung it. We've been singing it all since the beginning of the service. Can we really do that? As we take time this just now to acknowledge that the living God has provided for us, maintaining the cycle of the seasons with rain and sun and fertile soil, how can we develop this deeper understanding of the way in which the creation proclaims the glory of this majestic God? Now, most of Psalm 19 is all about the Bible itself. Do you notice that? A lot of it, much of it, let's say that, is about the Bible itself. Verses 7 to 11 explain that no matter how much the world around us preaches the glory of God, yet it's the study of the Bible that gives light to our eyes, wisdom to the simple, and is sweeter than the sweetest honey. The idea seems to be that left to ourselves, we don't tend to really see or understand the glory of God displayed in the world around us. Just on our own, we don't tend to do that. We tend to misconstrue it or ignore it. But the Bible acts as a kind of pair of glasses, correcting our vision, our eyesight, and giving us the ability to see what's really around us, aligning our vision. And as we learn to see the world as the Lord God sees the world, as we open our eyes and minds, open our minds to reality, then we see more and more of the glory that surrounds us. Psalm 19 gives us a great example of this in verses 4 to 6. King David knows that many of his readers would not be used to appreciating the glory of God in the creation around us. So he gives us one of the clearest examples to get us going. He's like said, the heavens declare the glory of God and constantly pour forth speech. I'll give you an example, he says. Let me give you one to get you started if you're not used to it. And he goes, verses 4 to 6. In the heavens, he's pitched a tent for the sun, the S-U-N, sun, which is like a bridegroom coming forth from his pavilion, like a bridegroom, like a champion, rejoicing to run his course. The sun rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is hid from its heat. Okay, so he's made several observations about the sun and drawn some conclusions about them. Let's think about that. We saw these great photos of the sun, didn't we? Rising and setting during the reading. It's really striking. So he kind of points to this daily cycle of sunrise, sun moving across the sky, and sunset. And he goes, look at that. Huh? yeah? So? And? Okay. Well, I don't know if you're scared of the dark, but if you have children, you'll have to face this reaction to darkness, won't you? Some kids have to have a nightlight on. Well, maybe adults do as well, I don't know. But kids, lots of kids, don't they, have to have a little nightlight on so that they never feel completely overwhelmed by darkness. I know with my children that if you switch off the landing light so it's totally dark, you get a reaction quite quickly. The Bible speaks of the terrors of the night. The terrors of the night. And the Psalms refer to the trials of the night. Our guilt, our worry is magnified by the night. And there's that sense in which we all know what that's like. You wake up in the night and our insecurities play on us. Everything gets out of proportion. We're more worried. Can't sleep. The trials of the night. Now, we might laugh about this reaction to the darkness, this reaction to the darkness as we get older. But is it really so strange to react like that to darkness? All our food depends on light. Except mushrooms. Do mushrooms need that? I think even mushrooms need a bit of light, don't they? I don't know about growing mushrooms. Maybe mushrooms. No, they need a bit of light. Anyway, we can't live just on mushrooms. light. You know, if we haven't got light, no food. Do we sense that? Even like little children, like, without the light, we're doomed. And we are. Light is life. The sun is life for us. Without the light, without the sunlight, without the light, there's only death. Cold, empty darkness. There's a reason that a fear of the dark comes naturally to us. There's a reason that David sees the dawn, sunrise, as like a champion achieving a victory. When the sun rises, the darkness is defeated. And the victory is so complete, so comprehensive. We never see the darkness beating the light. You know, some days, oh, the darkness won today. It's going to be one of those real dark days. It never happens, does it? Absolutely always the light beats the darkness. Every day. It's brilliant. It doesn't even resist the light. So it's not even as if the dark, it takes quite a long time for the light to get to us because the darkness is sort of fighting withdrawal. It just is, the darkness is powerless in the presence of the light. The Bible makes a lot of that. The darkness cannot understand or resist or even exist in the presence of light. As soon as the sun rises, the darkness is utterly defeated. I'm probably a little bit eccentric about this, but every time, you know, if I ever go in a dark room and switch the light on, I get a kick out of that. I'm like, the darkness is defeated. Be gone, darkness. Click. And I'm always blowing fuses and popping lights and things, like flicking it on and off, and, you know, probably the family are like, leave it alone. No, but you know what? Don't you think that's absolutely fantastic? The darkness, put the light on. Boom, defeated. No resistance. And it wasn't as if slowly a pool of light filtered out across the room. No, immediately, defeated. Be gone. it's little things. Please. Anyway. So, you know, I love to see that total victory of light over darkness. It's just absolutely, it's telling us something really fundamental. Incredibly profound every time it happens. It's telling us something about the future. It's telling us something about the past. It's telling us things about our own lives. It takes us back to the very first day of creation. That's what happened. That's how each day begins. The darkness is defeated, the light shines. That's how the whole universe began. Day one. The way all things were when Jesus created all things at the beginning. Let him be light, and he was light, and the darkness was not able to resist him. Then there was darkness. Then there was light, day one. Every day is a bit like day one. New beginning. Every day reminds us that light conquers the darkness. Every sunrise, we see the victory of the light once again. Every day when we see the dawn, we Jesus conquers the darkness. It's never been able to resist him. And even now, what a great testimony to it. Every morning, the Bible, in the Bible, this cycle of each day is, well, in the Bible, the cycle of each day is different than the way we culturally do it. See, you know, you'll know from Genesis 1, in the Bible, it goes, there was evening and then morning. First day, evening, morning, second day, evening, morning, third day. We don't do that, do we? We go middle of the night, night, day, night, a day, night, day, night, another day, night, day, night. See what we do? We begin in the middle of the night, then we have the day bit, and then we go back into the night and then end the day. Isn't that rubbish? Isn't that such a rubbish way of organizing a day? Why? Because what we're doing, no wonder so many of us get so gloomy and full of despair. Because every single day we experience it as darkness has the first word, light briefly comes, and then darkness takes over again. So our philosophy of each day is darkness. First word, last word. And light, yeah, it triumphs, but only for a little time. And darkness ultimately wins. See? I think it was Julius Caesar who invented that way of doing days. A pagan. Of course it's a pagan way of doing a day. It's rubbish. In the back, what we should experience each day of is darkness and then light. And then you end the day when the sun sets and say, right, that's it, let's start another day now. Darkness and then light. Light always has the last word. Light wins. Light that's a future is just light. With no darkness, like the great future, God's great future, there's no darkness further ahead. It's just light. So we should get into that pattern. Evening, morning. night then day. No wonder we're gloomy if we do this midnight rubbish. Anyway, I know, we should write to Greenwich or something and get him to change it. No, see, Psalm 19 points us to a true view of the world around us. See how the sun comes forth each morning like a mighty champion, achieving a glorious victory over the night, over the darkness. The sun defeats the darkness and gives light and life to all on earth. But notice also another thing David tells about the sun. The sun is not only a champion, but also a bridegroom. See that? Bridegroom. Bridegroom. Why a bridegroom? A bridegroom's a man on his way to a very special occasion. A bridegroom's a man on his way to get married. How comes the sun's like that? Why is the sun going? What special event is it heading towards? What future event is it pointing to or anticipating? You might know that how the Bible understands east and west. Sun rises in the east, sets in the west. No matter where you live in the world, that's true, isn't it? Because east and west are like, you know, doesn't matter where you live. Now, do you remember how the story of the Bible is? Adam and Eve kicked out, the exiled. They were rebelled against the living God, kicked out into exile. Where were they kicked out? East. Kicked out east, east of Eden. It says in Genesis 3, 23 and 24, they were kicked out to the east. They had some sons. Firstborn, a little bit of a disappointment. Cain, murderer, murdered Abel. Where did he go? Do you remember? Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. East. See, so that if you know this thing in the Bible, east, going east is going away from the presence of the Lord into exile. And so does everybody. Until the Lord appears to a man and his family, and he says to this man, his family, go west. Go west. It's Abraham. And he does. Now, of course, it isn't really like literally if you travel sufficiently west in that direction, you arrive back at paradise. It's a symbolic thing, you understand? It's a symbolic thing. So, east and west is this symbolism. The sun, right? The sun charts that out for us. You're a Tolkien fan. Who's a Tolkien fan? There must be somebody. Yay, there's at least one over there. So at least someone who's got the courage to admit that they are. Of course, loads of us are, really. We love the Lord of the Rings and stuff. Now, Tolkien, of course, Christian theologian, he has this stuff all deep in all that Middle Earth stuff and how to the west is where... they want to get back to the immortal land of the West across the... Anyway, I won't get started on that. Anyway, Psalm 19. The assumption is not just in the Bible and fantasy novels, though. Think about the way that European and American empire builders 200 years ago decided to call themselves the West. Why? The West of what? You can't just be the West, because everyone's West of other people or East of everybody else. Why? Because they knew what they were doing. They were making an ideological claim. They were saying, we are the West. We are the fulfillment of world history, Europeans and Americans. Tell you, if I was advising the leader of China, first thing I would say is, you want to call yourself the West? Redo the maps and say, no, we're the West. That's what I would do. Because the calling yourself the West in biblical terms and all these things, it means something, West. Now, all right, enough of that. I could easily get lost in this stuff. Now, I already have. So if East is being away from the Lord and West is moving back to paradise and the Lord's presence, then every day the sun, and this is what Dave is talking about when he says it rises and tracks, the sun goes across the heavens from one end of the heavens to the other. He's talking about this. He's saying every day the sun rises, triumphs over darkness, and then from the east it goes and sets in the west. And every day it's saying, yes, darkness can be defeated and there is a way back to paradise. I'm showing you like a bridegroom. Where's the sun racing off to? What marriage lies in the west? Where's it going? It's defeated the darkness, and where's it leading us back? There's a way back to paradise. The darkness can be defeated. Life, however bleak it looks, or however much we feel as if darkness and despair has the last word, we really look up with eyes to see and say, no, darkness is defeated. There's a way back to the presence of the living God. Every day, this solar bridegroom makes a journey to a glorious union, not literally, but symbolically. Every day the sun shows us that this way back. The sun preaches to us a wonderful message about a future wedding day, a day when the Lord Jesus, the Son of Righteousness, will be married to his people, when the whole creation will be transformed into the divine family home forever and ever, a home where there will be no night, no exile, no death, no darkness. The reason we feel so much better when the dawn breaks is that these deep truths are written deep into us, into the structure of the world around us. The plants and the animals reach towards the sun. And even at night, the merciful God has given us a faithful witness, the moon, to tell us the sun's still shining, even in the darkness. And the defeat of the darkness will come with the dawn. The moon's letting us know that. When Paul of Tarsus in the first century was writing to the Jesus followers of ancient Rome, he thought about one of those classic questions. How can people really trust in Jesus if they've never heard of him? Paul notes that people can only really trust in Jesus as they've heard the word of Christ. And yet, other people who've never heard of him. Is anybody in the world beyond the reach of Jesus, in other words? Paul turns back to Psalm 19, Romans chapter 10, verse 17 to 18. Faith comes from hearing the message, and the message is heard through the word of Christ. But I ask, did they not hear? Other people who have not heard of Christ, he says. Of course they've heard of him. And then he quotes Psalm 19, their voice has gone out into all the earth, the words to the end of the world. As we conclude, Psalm 19 tells us that the whole world is full of the glory of Jesus. We work with MAP, Mission to Asians in Preston, and for years we've worked to share Jesus with our Muslim friends and neighbors. And sometimes we think, how can we do this if they've never really studied Jesus, if they know so little about him? When we go out to live and speak the way, the truth, the life of Jesus, we are living and speaking the truth that is written into every aspect of the natural world around us. When we tell people about Jesus, we're not telling them about some unknown historical teacher, some merely human religious figure. We're telling them about the person who has been presented to them in every detail of life in the heavens and the earth. Jesus is the logic, the life, the light of the universe. And when we go out in his name, even the sun and the stars are backing us up. Jesus is Lord. Creation's voice proclaims it.